This is episode 19 of the Software Freedom Law Show. Hi, and welcome back to the Software Freedom Law Show. Well, we are back.
Well, you always say back. And last week,
I'm back.
Right. And last week, I even said welcome back because you always say that as the opening, which doesn't really make much sense. Although I was just thinking it might make sense if people are listening to them all in a row.
Then we go away very briefly and we come back while they load up the next.
If they made a playlist of all our shows, that would work. So we encourage you to make playlists of all our shows and listen to them in sequence over and over again on a running loop.
That.
I do.
You can say you do, but you can't say we do.
Why not? People should listen.
In any event, thanks to Aaron for a great show last week. And
it's weird we know he's in the next office.
He is in the next office.
I feel like we should go
get him. But, he'll listen to this and he'll be happy on the air. See, now you're using other terms that don't really make very much sense.
Yeah, we're not on the air. It's true. Yeah, and we're also just talking over each other, which is really bad for radio and podcasting.
That's an excellent point. I wanted to thank our listeners for their well wishes, actually, on my recovery, which makes my illness sound far more dramatic than it was.
Yeah, it was, in fact, just a cold.
So. It was just a cold. But I sounded terrible.
Okay. Yeah. Yep. Well, and it wasn't H1N1?
As far as I know, it was not.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw somebody, actually John Sullivan of the FSF, identified last night that he does not have H1N1, which I guess he was sick. And
maybe he went to the doctor.
And got tested to see if it actually was. So it's a dangerous world with dangerous viruses and software patents that we live in.
It's true.
So we did have one piece of feedback from last week, just a correction. We were reading the dates of some of the cases we talked about last week off of paper, and we transposed two numbers. And at one point during the show, we apparently said that the State Street case was 1998, and it's actually 1989. So that was a number transposition for which we apologize and did not want to give misinformation about when State Street was decided or anything like that.
We received a few other good points that that I think maybe we'll talk about once there's some movement in the Bilski case.
Yeah, after the hour and 15 minutes on software patents that people got last episode, I think we can give a break to the discussion of software patent cases and software patents and
move
else.
To something completely different.
Is that some sort of Monty Python?
It kind of is, yeah. Okay. But anyway, so what we've decided to talk about today is a completely different part of what we do here, which is, and we've talked about it at some points during our podcasts, which is the
Karen. I looked at my screen and I realized that we're going to do a whole show about IRS forms.
We certainly are.
So.
Are you warning people to hang up now? Shut off our podcast is what
for
I turn it off
to the next episode.
If they're listening to it in succession, as you
or
suggest,
or they could be listening to somebody else's episode.
That's
they could
true.
Have a Floss Weekly or a Linux Outlaws.
That's
lined
certainly
up next.
True. No, well, I think we should say before you switch us off in whatever manner you're going to, if you are going to, I would just want to say. Why our episode is going to be better than just talking about IRS forms.
And I will start out to point out one of the neat things when I fill out the forms we're going to be talking about. We're going to talk about the Form 990.
Soon as you say the number of the form,
But the thing is, when you open the thing, it has this little thing in the corner, and it says open to public inspection.
Right.
It looks just like my annual tax filing that I do for my own personal taxes, but as far as forms, because all IRS forms look relatively the same. But this open to public inspection thing is really kind of cool. It's a form designed to communicate things to the public, and that's, I think, why it's different and why it's worth talking about, even though it's an IRS form.
That's right. Well, nonprofits are organized for, essentially for the public interest and for many of them for public charitable purposes. And so the IRS requires that those organizations make certain information available on an annual basis so that donors and the public can see what kinds of special treatment organizations are getting. So in other words, if you're tax exempt, you're getting special treatment from the IRS. So the IRS says, well, you're getting that special treatment. You have to show why you deserve it.
Yeah, and I often say and remind people that charities operate in the public interest. I think it's not said enough. It kind of makes me a nonprofits geek to be focused on that and interested in that. But I think it's really important. And when I talk about these other things that I'm concerned about, how companies control and influence free software and troubles we have to have about it, the reason I'm not so worried about nonprofits is not just because I work in nonprofits and therefore I'm more comfortable with it, but also because there is this duty to act well for the public and operate in the public mm-hmm. good that a for-profit company doesn't have. A for-profit company operates on behalf of themselves to make money.
And behalf existence. Of their shareholders.
Shareholders, true.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that shareholders are kind of themselves. That shareholders
that's true.
Are part
that's
of the company
they,
in,
right.
in a certain kind of way.
Exactly.
But we're in a nonprofit, and other nonprofits are all designed to work on behalf of the public. Now, one of the things that happens is, as with any sort of complicated system, it's sometimes difficult for people to actually go and check these things and learn about the charities. And you'll see a lot of times on charitable giving websites when, how can I give money to charity? There's things that say, well, check their Form 990s and check the organization's mm-hmm. Work to make sure that your money's going to something good. I think lots of people have heard stories about charities that are almost scam type charities mm-hmm. that put too much into administrative overhead and other types of things.
They pay executives too high. They have inappropriate travel.
Right.
You know, spend money on drugs.
Well, I've heard about for-profit companies, Broadcom, doing that, but I've never heard about nonprofits doing that.
I have. I will not name the nonprofit in a cough or otherwise.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. The Broadcom stuff is very public, so it's not that. It was actually covered on Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Really?
Oh, yeah. It was a Wait, Don't Tell Me joke. Yeah. Once it was on Wait, Don't Tell Me, I decided that talking about the Broadcom thing publicly, because Broadcom has Linux-based systems and they're connected to the free software world in that way. So I figured it was talking about it publicly was no big deal. And there's worse things we could talk about in the free software world.
Anyway. So, one of the problems
with... I was making it salacious so the people who are about to turn off because we're
Well, this is the really interesting thing is that there are sometimes these salacious facts buried in the Form 990 because organizations are required to make certain disclosures, but to talk about the things that they're doing. And sometimes the questions are quite specific. And so they have to answer yes, or, you know, you'll see how much money an organization put towards legal fees, or you'll see how much an organization spent towards something else. And it's really informative and you can draw a lot of conclusions based on that. So there's actually a lot of information out there that the IRS requires, but it's in a format that's somewhat difficult to negotiate. So if you take a look at it, if you decide to look at a Form 990, sometimes organizations make their Form 990s available directly through them, but sometimes you have to go through other sources. But when you look at it, it just looks like a tax form and it's a bit impenetrable. So we thought what we would do is walk you through an example Form 990 and show you the really important things, the things that you should look at if you're interested in how organizations spend their money and whether they're doing what you think they're doing.
So what example should we use, Karen?
Well, Bradley, I think we should use the Software Freedom Conservancy's Form 990 since you just filed it. And
so
it's
you're putting
recent.
Me on the spot? You're putting the Form 990 of the organization I'm a president of on the spot?
You've publicly filed it.
That's true. It's open for public inspection, as it says
up
in the corner.
We talked about it before we decided to record this episode.
Well, I know we did, but I was trying to...
See, you had it already up on your screen. We've been looking at it.
Break the third wall, whatever you call it. You have to say, I was trying to build it up as something interesting, talk about it.
I think our listeners will want to know that the entire time we've been talking, we've had the 990 EZ in front of us, and you just pretended like it wasn't even there.
But I was trying to make it interesting for our listeners. We're talking about tax forms on a podcast,
it's
and we're
true.
Not a tax podcast. So I think we may have lost people already. So I was trying to make it.
Well, I think the first thing we should talk about is how people can get.
Should we talk about people on IRC talking to me and popping up on the screen on top of the 990? I guess
no.
not. Yeah. As for people who don't know, I have a little purple thing that pops up when somebody tries to talk to me on IRC, addresses me directly, and it's popping up right now in front of the 990, but I will answer them later. I think that we maybe should take a break just to give people a chance if they want to go and pull up the 990 before we dig into it.
Yeah, we're going to have it linked.
It's going to be on the conservancy's side. I'll make sure it's up in parallel. Let's talk about that for a minute before we go for a break.
Okay.
A lot of organizations, usually I think because they forget or it is a lot of work to file the 990. I think when people are done, mm-hmm. they're just like, I'm done. I don't want to think about it.
I can tell you it's an incredibly joyous experience to be finished.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and as it was for us for conservancy, SFLC is working on theirs right now for fiscal 2008. right? So you guys will be glad when it's done. And I think a lot of times, most of the organizations just forget to put it up on their website. But you can write to the organization and request it. And you can also go to a site called GuideStar.com, which is for-profit.
.org.
It's .org, so they're a nonprofit.
I think they're GuideStar.org. Okay. Well, maybe
it
I'm
may
wrong.
Be right. Maybe GuideStar.
Oh, we should check that.
We're going to use to internets in real time. We'll sound like Fab now typing.
I don't know if they are if they are a nonprofit or not, but they're
okay, well,
designed for.
They are a website. It's GuideStar.org, GUIDESTAR.org.
Do they have .com as well?
I don't know.
Okay.
It's .org and it's up, so we know what it is. And they're a site design. They have various pay services. That's how I assume they stay in business. But if you just sign up for a default account, you can get at least the Form 990s from the organization. They have other information you can get for pay. But the Form 990s, because they're public, it's really the best source to get to do a search for an organization that you're interested in and find where they're incorporated, how long they've existed, and their Form 990s.
And they get Form 990s either from the organizations themselves, because many organizations know that people are looking on GuideStar for the Form 990s, so they'll just provide them so that they have the more recent numbers. Mm-hmm. But also GuideStar, I think, just systematically files with FOIA, Freedom of Information Act requests with the IRS to get...
Yeah, I know that. I know they do because I forgot to send them Conservancy's 2007, and they had it because they got it from the IRS.
Yeah.
So they took care of it. But we're going to put the 2008 right up on the Conservancy's website, and you can look at sfconservancy.org and find the it'll be linked somewhere. I don't know the exact URL because I haven't made it yet.
And we'll at least put a link to the Conservancy website in the
It'll be in the show notes.
Show notes.
So you can just actually go to the show notes and follow links. That will work. And we'll
try to speak as generally and as interestingly as possible, right, yeah. So that if you don't have it in front of you,
if you have it in front of you, it'll probably be I think it'll be kind of like when we do talks and have the slides.
Yep.
I think it'll be good for people even if they don't have the slides and the document in front of them.
That's
but if
what
they
we'll
do,
strive
it'll
for.
Be an added benefit multimedia experience if they do.
Excellent. So we'll be right back. I was expecting you to give me a hard time about saying we'll be right back.
Well, in this case, it's accurate.
Well,
they just heard a little bit of music.
It's true. But you said we're not really back. I mean, if that's true, then we're back. Whatever. We now are sitting with the – well, we were before.
Did you ever see that Saturday Night skit that Jimmy Fallon used to do? He used to do one of those Viacom/Clear Channel annoying DJ people.
I don't think so.
Every time after commercial, he would go, and we're back. Like all those stupid DJs do.
You really had to see Bradley's expression there. It's great.
Well, and then they did a thing on Family Guy making fun of that.
Okay.
Where Stewie and Brian did a show together.
That's funny.
Called Dingo and the Baby.
That's hilarious.
Because Brian's the dog.
It's certainly.
I don't know how much you need to know Brian.
Well, I do know. I've seen a few episodes.
Yeah, I've seen Brian's a dog. So
that's great.
Yeah, it was just like one of those Clear Channel things. Yeah. Aaron was bothered last week at the over TV stuff. And I explained to him last week that there's got to be some TV references.
Well, now
about Benson.
Now that we've gotten that over with.
Talk about Benson.
We are sitting here with the Form 990 EZ in front of us.
Now, let's be clear. The regular host knows Benson, right?
Did Aaron not know Benson?
Aaron did not know Benson.
Huh. He is young.
He's young.
He's not really that much young. He's not really young. I want to clarify for listeners.
He's young compared to us, I think.
No, he's maybe young compared to you.
That's true. I am old.
Only because you think of yourself as old.
That's true. I'm getting close to 40.
Anyway.
I am. It's a fact.
Anyway, I guess everyone's getting closer to 40 who's under 40.
You're older than you've ever been.
And that was the Murphy Giants reference.
That's true. It was.
Okay.
So now we've done the obligatory TV references. Now we can talk about the Form.
And music.
I didn't really want to do this reference. That was sort of an accident.
We're sitting here looking at the Conservancy's Form 990 EZ. And what the EZ is it's a shorter form that the IRS makes available for smaller organizations so that it's not as burdensome.
Yeah, I was really sad when I wasn't able to file a 1040 EZ anymore when I was younger.
Yeah.
Because it's the same as people have their personal taxes. They have the choice between the 1040 and 1040 EZ.
Yeah. So the EZ is great. One of the things that you would note if you were to look at this is right at the top of it says the name of the organization. It has this little front top. And at the bottom of this, top section, it says organization type in J. And it says,
not J. Just to be clear, that's the J is part J in the form.
Okay, it's the first J that you see if you're looking at it. Well, but
they might not know what people. I'm doing that for people not looking at the form because they might not know what we mean by J. That's why I was saying part J. I'm sorry.
Okay, I was actually trying not to talk too much about where things were for people who didn't have the form in front of them. But it is one of the first things that you see is that it has a little checkbox for what kind of organization it is. So you can see if you're looking at the Conservancy's Form 990 that it's a 501c3. So it's filled in 501c and then we filled in 3 there. You can look there and see if the organization is a trade association, it'll have a 6. There.
Right. And if people want to check out the differences about that, we talked about those somewhat extensively in the interview mm-hmm. with Karen Copenhaver that we did, because Linux Foundation is a 501c6, C6 and
right.
or C3. So that's if you go back and refer to that show, you can remember what the differences are. And then this is a place where you can find out.
You can see right away.
Yeah.
So some organizations, it may be a little confusing. It may not be obvious right away what kind of organization it is. And that's when you can see directly what the difference is. And those other differences that we talked about with Karen, like, whether a trade association, which is representing common business interests of their members, as opposed to a 501c3, which is a public charity, you can see right away. So anyway, moving right along. The top line where you have, not the top line where there's a number, but
in part one. Line one. people might be looking.
This is
a discussion of what basically donations that an organization's got, right?
If you're wondering what the total amount of money that's come in during that year that the organization is living on, you can
in the form of donations.
In the form of donation, well, yeah, contributions and gifts and grants, you can see in that line.
Yeah. Then there's another line, which is also income as well, which is mm-hmm. program service revenue.
Well, there are a few, but the second one.
The one that's a major one is.
The second one is it's program service revenue. And what that means is we also call it sort of related business income. It's income.
Yeah, that's sort of the nonprofit geek speak for what this is, right?
So what it is.
If people read books and stuff, they'll probably encounter that term. And if they read about nonprofits, they would encounter that.
Right. And what it actually is it's money that the organization takes in for services provided. So, it's pay for services or pay for goods that are related to the organization's mission. So something that furthers the nonprofit purpose.
Where's the general line between something that's a donation and something that's related business income?
Well, I mean, sometimes the line is gray. Mm-hmm. And there are many, many IRS rulings about different, like, advertising, for example. Mm-hmm. And it's really like many things in the law, it's extremely fact dependent. So it's different in slightly different cases. But it's basically a judgment call. Usually it's pretty easy to know. Like, are you getting something when you pay for your money? Like, are you going to get something in return? Is it just a donation to support the organization, or are you getting, a subscription to a service? Are you getting a registration at a conference? You know, what is it that's coming back? And the number for Conservancy, when we're looking at it here, is actually, I think it's a significant number when you compare with contributions. And so why I thought it would be good to talk about the Conservancy's annual report is because now we can say the kinds of things that are program service revenue.
Actually, now to break down the host's wall, I sort of asked you that like I didn't know. I actually know. I was just doing that for podcasting.
Well, of course, we've talked about it extensively.
But then I realized when the way I asked that, it made me sound like I was like asking you like I didn't know, which I was actually trying to do because I was trying to be a good host. But
it's
then
funny,
I realized
but then you were
dumb.
Asking in a way that was problematic because I want to answer the question and it's so hard to answer it. But usually it's not that hard to figure it out.
Well, yeah, in Conservancy's case, the big thing here, there's probably a few little things starting in there, but the main thing that made up that number in fiscal year 2008 for us, I have a feeling every time I say fiscal year, that makes people want to turn off the podcast.
Yeah, just say last year.
Okay, but it's the fiscal year.
But just say last year.
It's not the calendar year.
It's okay.
I wish our fiscal year was on the calendar year, to tell you the truth. But it's
can always change it.
Well, that's true.
The board can always change it.
It's a lot of work.
It is a lot of work.
And I don't want to deal with that work. Anyway, the reason, by the way, we got a fiscal year this way is because of when we incorporated. And so we started the year when we incorporated, and that's why.
It actually minimizes the initial filing by following the fiscal year, by following the time that you incorporated. So it's usually advantageous to start this way, and then you're kind of stuck with it.
Yep.
And it's actually, in some ways, it's nice because a lot of nonprofit organizations, similarly, a lot of companies follow a calendar year. So if you follow that, then you're on the same schedule as everybody else, which sometimes means that, like, if you're using accountants that other people use or other kinds of resources that other people need, it's going to be like regular tax time. We're on April 15th. The line is, you know, around the block to...
Karen, when did you and I become complete admin type geeks about this kind of stuff? We're sitting here talking about why fiscal years are, and I'm really interested. I'm like, yeah, that's a really good point. And I feel like I'm really a software developer. I really am. Mm-hmm. I swear. But anyway, I'm somewhat of a fiscal paperwork geek, at least when it comes to nonprofits.
We like when things are done right, and we want to make sure that our obligations and our clients' obligations are looked after appropriately.
Yeah.
So that's why we care about this. We care about this stuff because we care about free software.
Yeah, but we're kind of geeky about it. Well, caring's one thing, but being kind of geeky about it, we've crossed the line somewhere.
Right. I think you might be right.
Anyway, so let's be geeky about it. So in line two, what ends up happening for us for this related business income or program service revenue, whatever term you use, in conservancies case, it was primarily because of conferences. A lot of conservancy projects like to have conferences, and the Boost project in particular has a really big conference every year. They're a C++ library project for those who actually want some computer geek stuff in here. It's a really good library. It sort of builds on top of the standard template library. Anyway, they have an annual conference where they talk about improvements in software and to meet everybody in the community and all that sort of thing. And sometimes they have income from that conference where people pay for the registration fees, and that's where that money comes from. So it's not really a donation because people are getting a service, so to speak. They're getting the opportunity to attend a conference and they're paying a registration fee for the conference. So it's not a pure donation. So it has to go there. Am I explaining that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, program service revenue is a good thing to look at because those are usually things where the organization is taking in money for services they're providing that are consistent with what they say they do. Mm-hmm. So it's actually I think it's confusing the way it's worded on the form, I think program service revenue or related business income or whatever you want to call it is when you look at it, it's good to see how it fits in with the general amount of contributions, but also, you know, I think some people think, oh, well, it's just money that they've been taking by selling stuff. And that's not necessarily true. And even if it is, whatever they're selling is promoting their charitable purpose. Mm-hmm. So that's interesting. You'll see in the next line, which is membership dues and assessment, that the conservancy has zero. And that's because the conservancy has no membership program. While the conservancy has member projects, it doesn't have members the way that some organizations have membership.
I have a curious question that I actually don't know the answer to. If we, because conservancy doesn't charge its members, charge mm-hmm. projects to join, but if we charge projects
to join. I was thinking that too while I was saying it.
Yeah, I
think it probably would qualify in there. In the similar way, if you look at a trade association annual report, you'll see
three is really big.
Three is really big.
Because that's where all the money comes
exactly,
from.
Exactly.
Companies joining.
And they tend not to have that much in the contributions, gifts, and grants. Right. And some organizations, like I'm using Linux Foundation again as an example, have two kinds of membership
Linux
programs.
Linux Foundation is a good example. Because it's probably the best known C6 in the community.
So. And they've actually got two kinds of membership programs now. They've got the membership from their trade association members who actually have control of the organization.
Individual.
And they have individual.
It's new. It just launched this year.
Yeah, exactly. So members can join as individuals, which, you know, I think it's really interesting to see how those things play out in terms of the numbers.
Yeah, the other number you'll see in there is investment income, and generally that's bank interest, that kind of thing. So
sometimes, you know, sometimes organizations have a lot of money in the bank and they can actually go out and make investments. But in my experience, that's the exception.
That's probably, certainly in conservancies form, those are the only places where there's stuff on the revenue lines. And it's probably those are the most interesting revenue lines to look at, I would bet. So, in the interest of concision, maybe.
Yeah, I think that's probably the thing.
Talk about expenses.
But if we look at expenses, the first thing is in that section is grants and similar amounts, which in the conservancy is quite low.
Yeah, in this particular year it was low.
Yeah.
But sometimes we have other grant stuff that we do, but this year, actually, I know, because I see that $29.98 on our form. That was a book we bought for a Google Summer of Code student.
Oh, okay.
And I know exactly what that was. So that's the kind of thing it is, where you give something to, in a software development nonprofit, to a software developer to write some code, or any type of thing where you're giving an individual some money.
Well, that depends, actually, because that might not be qualified as a grant. That might be work for hire.
True enough. And actually, we have some of that in conservancy.
Yeah,
case.
Exactly.
The Google Summer of Code program is a classic place where there's grant money.
Yeah, and if you see an organization that says that they have a lot in grants, they have to attach a schedule that says what that is. Conservancy, it was so small that they don't have to do that, but you'll see in other organizations that they have to explain what the grant was for.
Yeah, when you see that large in the case of Conservancy, it's often the payments to the mentors of Summer of Code. Mm-hmm. And in other years, you might see that larger in Conservancy, and it's usually that's why, because the mentors get a stipend for basically mentoring the student during the Summer of Code, and that gets handled through the Conservancy.
So, right.
But this particular year, the Summer of Code, because of the weird fiscal year-ness, none of the Summer of Code money actually happened in this particular year, because fiscal years are weird.
So another thing in that section is the salaries and employee benefits. So you can see that as on a summary basis, which is really useful. And you'll see that Conservancy is zero because it doesn't have any.
I can attest that there are no employees, in fact. So that's why we paid no salaries.
But then, you know, we were talking before about grants by hiring developers to work for Word. Mm-hmm. You know, I think some of that here is considered independent contractors, which is the next professional fees and other payments to independent contractors.
Right. So we're going to talk in a minute when we get to the next
page.
We're
hiring developers.
In the Conservancy case, we're going to talk in a minute about what particular thing this was for, but it was basically an independent contractor that was paid to do software development as opposed to a grant given. And that really just depends on how it's, I guess, characterized or what's the best way to.
Yeah, I mean,
it's hard
to
make a line.
Yeah,
I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, in some usually it's pretty clear when you're
right. In this case, it was a consulting company that was doing the work, so it made more sense to have it characterized this way. It's
usually, if there's billing by the hour, it looks like a contractor rather than a grant. Usually, for a grant, you fund a project and you get reports and that kind of thing. I think that's it. Probably that's interesting on the actual form. You can look at it and you can see summaries of other expenses, but you know, the only really useful part about that, I think, is looking at the total amount spent versus the total amount received, mm-hmm. and just thinking about, you know, how much did the organization spend, and is that a reasonable amount? You don't want an organization that holds on to too much of what it gets, because the money that it's getting as donations is for, you know, for use to further the nonprofit activities. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, you want to see a sustainable organization.
Yeah, in fact, you know, historically, you know, that's when I was at FSF, one of the things when I first came into FSF that I did was we had been carrying a lot of money over and not putting it to work. And we strived when I first got there to really put that money back into work, because we had a couple of years where people were giving donations and there wasn't a lot of, people know historically FSF has had periods of inactivity in its history. When I came in, we began a period of activity and we tried to get that so it wasn't the case. Because you want to see an organization putting the donors' dollars to use, because the donors could invest the money themselves and save it and wait for an organization to come along doing the work they care about. So there's no real reason to donate to an organization that's just going to save it.
Yeah. I mean, mostly. If you're thinking about, if you're choosing between organizations to donate to, you don't want to give it to someone that's just going to put it in the bank and forget about it. Right. So the only other useful piece on this
page,
I think...
Conservancy did carry over a large amount of money because certain projects haven't decided how to spend it.
Well, actually, the Conservancy is a sort of a slightly different model here, actually. And we'll get to this later when we talk about restricted funds. But but because the Conservancy is holding money on behalf of certain projects, you know, it's kind of different.
That's true. Well, it's different in the sense that I can't, as president of Conservancy, decide how to spend most of its money. Most of its money are in directed donation accounts for a specific project, but the project leaders can decide how to spend them. So what I was talking about was that some of the project leaders are still thinking, they've gotten donations, they're still trying to figure out what the best way to spend the money is.
And it's also disproportionate amongst the different members. So if you look at it, don't think that that's an even amount in all the different projects. It's not necessarily representative.
Would like to draw attention to the fact that they need donations.
Exactly. You can't just look at the overall Conservancy filing and say, oh, well, you know, Project A, you know, is saving all this money when really it's Project B.
Yeah. In fact, there are projects in Conservancy that have absolutely no money and have never had it.
Right.
So, and there are some that have large amounts. are relatively large amounts. You can see that if you're looking at the form, you see the order of magnitude numbers we're talking about. The other part I want to draw, I think we're the first page is where all the real summary information is, so that's where probably you focus a lot. The other part of the form I think is really worth looking at is part three. In the case of the EZ, it might be a different part on the regular 990, but it's the part where you list some major accomplishments of the organization in the year and how much was spent on them. And this is a really good place to look to see how the organization has decided to summarize its work and what it's claiming is the really important work of its organization, because the instructions for this form say pick your three largest and describe the work. It's hard to get a good sense, but if you know the organization well, you can figure it out. Because I had a lot of trouble. Karen and I went back and forth for conservancies as we were trying to draft the best way to fit in the three.
I know,
little
you can't
lines
fit that much in. Usually, you can also attach a statement, and a lot of organizations do.
The new instructions they say you were encouraged not to attach schedules.
But
gotten aggressive.
But a lot of organizations attach statements.
I know they do, but if they're going to say they really don't want it, I try to obey the rules. You know.
Yeah. Well, what's different in the regular 990 and as opposed to the EZ is that in the regular 990, they do say, like, you know, what are your top program expenditures? You have to actually list it by what you spent the most on.
Mm, yeah.
So here you chose three of the big ones.
Yeah.
So the first was always we talked about before was conferences, and you can see the amounts. Maybe we should just start moving a little faster.
Yeah,
but
you can read it and see what some of the major things we were. And you'll notice there, by the way, we were referencing before the contractor that was paid. That was actually for the some improvements. And there's actually, you can go on the Twisted website for the Twisted project. They did a project where they were funding somebody to do bug fixes and key things, you know, the kind of things in projects that just don't get done because they're not as fun and they're not big features, but they're bugs that need to be closed. And so they funded, they contracted out the work to an agency, and a guy there was working on doing that on a regular basis. And he blogged about it publicly, which was really fun. Every 2 weeks, I think, or maybe it was every month, he posted a blog post of all the tickets and track that were closed and what he had done and what the work was funding. It was really, I tried to build it as a good model for how to fund free software projects in a really transparent way where everybody in the community knew he was getting money for it and he was publicly saying what the money was going to.
I actually think it's a really good example of sort of best practices for handling this kind of expenditure by a nonprofit. And, you know, it's a good way of handling, you know, either grants or well, in this case, contractors, when you have public interest money being spent.
Yeah, and that's the neat thing. When you think about a contractor doing work in the public interest compared to what they would do in a for-profit space, what was happening was the community, i.e. the public interest, was directing that work and giving him feedback on what they thought was important. And then he was going and looking at those tickets that people had flagged that were important and working on them. So it was really, I think, a good way to look at the free software side of what nonprofits can do, because for-profit companies do contribute to free software projects all the time. But if you looked at IBM's filings, tax filings, you would find that was a business expense that they did. And because they did some improvement to Linux, they were able to sell this many more units. And that's where the profit motive was for them. But when you look at a nonprofit funding free software projects, you're seeing the public wanted the software to improve in a certain way. And then they were funding that improvement. And I think that's really a neat aspect of how nonprofits can be used for advancement of free software.
Yeah, this is also a useful way to check up on nonprofits. If you're deciding whether or not you should give a donation to an organization, you can look in this section and then sort of look around online to see what evidence of this project there is. If it's a public-facing project, you know, for example, you could look at the Twisted development and you can see what was done and you can look at it and say, oh, okay, wow, that really looks like $27,000 worth of work. And if you do that same kind of search for, you know, something else that some other organization has done where maybe they didn't spend the money very effectively, you could say, oh, well, actually, that's a lot of money to spend to not get that much done. So it's a really good place to start.
And so in part four is actually really boring in the Conservancy's case, because that's where they list all the officers and people who have decision-making power in the organization. And how much they make.
You see their salaries.
Yep. You see how much they make and how much they get in benefits and how much they get in expense accounts.
Usually this is the juicy part.
It is juicy in some cases because you find out how much people are making. But as you can see, I've often said all my work for Conservancy is done as a volunteer, and I have filed with ERS that, in fact, that is true. You can see my compensation and benefits are zero from Conservancy. I get nothing. In fact,
and you can see mine is zero.
I buy all Conservancy stamps myself, which I totally should get reimbursed for, but I actually donate stamps to Conservancy. All the Conservancy stamps are bought by me.
Hey, we thank you. So donate to Conservancy if you'd like to support our stamps.
No, I'm doing all the stamp purchasing at the moment. So,
we can ask.
I could actually get reimbursed. I just never bothered to fill out the reimbursement form. You can see Karen's on there as our legal counsel, and she also serves as the corporate secretary for the board.
Yeah, the word term secretary is a little weird because like I'm a receptionist.
I know, but it's the person who takes notes at the meetings. You know?
Well, it's the person who monitors all the corporate records, which is actually different than...
They call it something different in Massachusetts, actually, I believe.
Oh, you mentioned this once.
I was it, too. It was the clerk. Right, the clerk of the corporation.
Right.
Which sounds even worse than secretary in a way. I was the clerk of FSF for many, many years, actually. I was the clerk of FSF.
You'll often find that whether it's a general counsel, often they're also the secretary.
Yeah.
So those two positions go, because of the legal documentation aspect of it.
And in the EZ, it's part five, and maybe others.
Oh, and you had a great way of looking at it. So if you don't want to pay attention to anything else in the form, but you want to get the information, as much information out of it as possible. Bradley.
Part five specifically.
Part five. But actually, generally, most of the questions that are not sort of the financial information questions, you basically just look down the list and you'll see a whole bunch of no's generally. If you see a yes, take a look and see what it is.
Yeah.
That's basically what.
That usually means they had to file additional information or they did something that was. That required them to explain a certain behavior.
So I was sort of like, let's see if there are any questions here we want to spend any time on. And Bradley was like, there were no yeses. So therefore, there's really not much to look at. And I think generally that's the case. There's a lot of questions here about unrelated business income. So is that what you're pointing out to me? Oh, okay. Yeah. No, well, so there are questions about unrelated business income, which is different than the income that we were talking about before, which we called program service revenue.
Yeah.
Unrelated business income is income that's not related to the nonprofit mission of the organization. So, but that can be anything. That can be, you know, I want to sell mugs with my organization's logo on them, mm-hmm. or I want to sell other kinds of merchandise. It's not necessarily.
Oh, so mug sales and t-shirt sales are unrelated?
Oh, Bradley, you're deliberately asking me these questions that are on the edge. They are generally generally unrelated business income, but there are times if it's an advocacy organization and the t-shirt or the mug has, you know, is fulfilling that purpose,
it's related business income. If there were an organization
uh-huh.
that happened to print the preamble of the GPL on the back of a t-shirt as a way to encourage people to know about GPL.
What made you think of that example?
And perhaps this organization is also the author of GPL. Perhaps their t-shirts will be related business.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good example of the kind of thing that's much more on the edge. I think people would generally tell you that that merchandise sales are unrelated, but there are circumstances where they could be related.
Mm-hmm.
So there you have it. So
get your GPL t-shirt if you don't have one already.
Buy merch from the FSF. Is what we're saying.
Merch?
Merch?
I don't like the... I don't.
Oh,
like that.
As a music person, merch is just...
Really?
You know,
is that one of those
Yeah,
words?
There's band merch. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't like that word. Or that abbreviation. I don't know
why. All right. I'm not sure why either, but okay.
It bothers me for some reason.
So,
I'm trying to think of what it reminds me. It reminds me of something people abbreviate a lot.
I don't know.
What is it?
But,
app. It's app. Like app. It's okay. Like instead of saying a software application, people say app. I hate that.
Yeah.
And that's what it made me think of.
I think the cat's out of the bag on that one.
Well, no, but Apple uses it so we can hate it with impunity.
I just think that I think so many people use that term that I don't think it's related to Apple.
If anybody catches me using that, you can flame me. I probably have, and I've probably done it on like Identica because I didn't have 140 characters. Uh-huh. Karen looks amazingly bored that I'm talking about the number of characters I read on Identica. But anyway, so
no,
if you catch me using it, you can flame me.
What I was actually doing was trying to get back to the Form 990. This next section is completely blank on the Conservancy as well, but it is also a potentially juicy section for other nonprofit organizations because it shows how much employees are paid.
Right. Similar basically to part three, but part three only covers the officers, directors, people with decision-making power. Whereas in this case, it's line 50 on the 990 EZ. It's any employee, right? It's just
and it's only the top five, and it's only if they make over $100,000.
Yeah.
So it's limited, but that's why it gets particularly juicy, is it's only people who are getting paid a lot.
Yeah. Well, in the old years, it used to be 50, but obviously inflation, they increased it. Right. When did they increase that? It's recently, because I remember
I think it's with this form, but I'm not entirely sure. I'm not entirely sure. Yeah. Don't.
Oh, and you actually have to say the total number of employees beyond the five that are paid more than 100,000.
Yeah, because you may list the top five, but then have another 20 employees that are just behind. Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty much for the main form. Most C3 organizations also have to file something called a Schedule A, which is basically to make sure that the organization is truly being supported by the public. And there's a whole lot of complicated formulas.
We've talked about it a little bit in past episodes, but we won't bore you with the whole calculation.
Yeah, yeah. Karen's an expert on the whole public support test.
Well, I get asked a lot of questions about it, so yeah. I don't know if I'm an expert so much as I've done a lot of research into it.
Wait a second. Karen, what else is an expert but somebody who has done lots of reading and well-informed on a subject?
That's an excellent point, but, I mean, an expert implies that there aren't,
You're just afraid because the expert has some sort of special meeting for lawyers. Is that it? That if you call an expert, does that some sort of whistle and bell that?
I see. Oh, you mean like an expert witness?
Yeah.
I don't think so necessarily, okay. But.
Are you afraid of being subpoenaed about public support tests?
I think if we're completely honest, I think I was just trying to be modest.
Okay. Don't be modest. You know a lot about this. And I always ask Karen my public support test questions.
Well, so it's good to look here because what you can see here...
It's confusing to look here.
It's very confusing to look here. I would
actually, back up a moment. Okay, if you have decided you don't want to be a form geek like us, you could probably just stop at what you read. If you read up to the Schedule A you felt comfortable with the organization...
I would actually flip to this page. Because
you're talking about this. I guess
yes.
Page two. Of
and I would look at only one number on this entire form.
What's the number should they look at?
It's not in the conservancy's filing because the conservancy is a new organization. Because you can see that you only have to fill out this particular number if it's not the organization's first through fifth tax year. So it's section C, line number 14 and 15. That's where you see the percentage of public support. There's a complicated test for determining what that public support is, but generally you can see whether the organization is supported by a broad base or whether it's only supported by a few organizations or individuals.
So roughly speaking, that number is a kind of an index into how much of their support comes from a diverse group.
Exactly. Yeah.
So that percentage is the percent of diversity. Basically, in their funding, roughly. I know it's very rough.
Roughly, yeah, really roughly. But it's an indicator. Now, for some organizations, that matters less. Some organizations you can tell immediately that they're public facing and they're a public charity. For others, you might be alarmed by having a low number here because it might indicate that they may be influenced by one or two individuals who are giving a lot of money.
Either individuals or companies that give. I mean, that's the real word.
Individual donors, but
individual donors, right?
Yeah. It could be a rich individuals, as it often is, with personal agendas, or it could be organizations like companies that are giving a lot of money for their own corporate agenda.
Yeah. So what's I know that 33 1/3 is the magic number that the IRS likes. Do you have a number that you like that you
think? It's really different from organization to organization. For me, it really depends what the organization is doing. I know some really good organizations that do publish lots of public materials and educational materials. They're very public facing. They are only supported by a few individuals. Therefore, their number there is low. I'm less troubled by it. It's organizations that aren't very public, that you don't know what they're doing, where if that number is low, I actually am not really too troubled if it's lower than 33 1/3. There's another test, which you'll see if you're looking at the form, it's line 17A, the 10% facts and circumstances test. But then the IRS requires that the organization state what it's doing that makes it a public charity. So it's a good place to look. And if it's low, then they have a reason why and they explain what they're doing and you can judge that accordingly. Mm-hmm. So that's the only thing I would look at on that form.
So I think that pretty much wraps up the actual walking through the form.
I would talk about, maybe we should take a break and come back to how we prepared the form.
Probably forgot to mention that in addition to filing this, which is a federal form, people also have to file some form with the state that they're incorporated in, mm-hmm. generally, or Commonwealth.
All the states have different rules about what they require. Some don't require very much at all, but some require quite a bit. New York, which which the conservancy is organized in, actually has more requirements.
Right. Well, the main requirement is you have to file a copy of Reform 990 with them. But then right. also, if you have over a certain amount of money, you have to get extra work done by an accounting firm.
Right. So there are sort of two thresholds in New York. One is that you get a full audit of your financials. Mm-hmm. And the other, which is a lesser requirement for organizations that are sort of a medium size and the conservancy fit into that. Mm. And that's getting a limited review where the auditors don't give a full audit. They don't look at all the controls in the organization, but they do review all the books and records and just do some reviewing of the numbers. So that was an interesting experience for the conservancy this year.
Yeah, I was fortunate. I have, obviously being a computer geek, I have everything electronically, all the financial records. I do it actually myself as a volunteer. And
I'm so impressed with how you do it.
I use a software system called Ledger, which is completely command line accounting system. It's written by Jay Wegley, who is probably more famously known for one of the original authors of the planner system for GNU Emacs, but he wrote this other thing in C++ called Ledger. And you actually have to, if you want to search for it on the net, search for command line Ledger, because Ledger is obviously a common accounting term.
And you'll find other names.
And there's other software that have Ledger in their name. So the best thing to do is search for command line Ledger. You'll find Jay Wegley associated with it. He's on one of the Git sites, and you can get a clone of his tree. So I use his system, and I store all the documents in a repository.
I think the accountants were pretty impressed with it, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't think they were.
Because it was much easier for the conservancy to generate reports that other that they have.
Yes, I only see it from conservancy's blinders, right. And it is a lot of work, and they wanted a lot of stuff, and it did take a lot of time. Like, they want to look at invoices, I had to send them PDFs of all sorts of
invoices. And it's not nearly what we would have had to have done if it had been an audit, a full audit. Yeah, but it was not a full audit.
Well, wow.
So it's really interesting. But what's cool about New York is that New York requires that this be done, and then it requires that the report be filed with them, with their CHAR 500, which is their report. Right. So you can actually, if you want further information and you know the organization is a New York organization, for example, you can find out from that New York filing, you can see their audited review.
Yeah, and for Massachusetts organizations, because I just happen to know about Massachusetts because I used to be the clerk of FSF, as I mentioned, the Massachusetts website has filings. And there's actually their annual filing for a nonprofit's much smaller. It's a one-page thing, which just basically says when the last board meeting was and who the directors are. And you can go to the Massachusetts Secretary of State website if it's a Massachusetts organization. So that's another source of information. But I really think that if you want to be if you want to consider yourself an informed consumer, mm-hmm. as it were, or informed donor, I guess is a better phrase to use here, go get a Form 990 for the organization, look at the last few years, see where their money's going, see who they're paying money to. And the neat thing about free software organizations is most of these leaders in the free software community who might be associated with the organization, you know them by name. You've probably met them at conferences. Yep. If you go to conferences, if you don't, you've probably read their blog. So you actually get a sense of who's actually being compensated by these organizations.
And most organizations want you to be involved with their activities. So, you know, they want you to care about the organization and find out about them. Mm-hmm. So I think that the wrap-up plug for this should be go out there and donate to free software nonprofits that you think are worthwhile. Check out their Form 990, see what they're doing, and kick them a few bucks.
Yeah, certainly something that I've brought up a lot. We talked about this a lot on the GNOME mm-hmm. Podcast we did with Stormy Peters. And Stormy and I have both been out there trying to say this more. Stormy, I think, just has been putting in her talks lately to give more to lots of nonprofits. And not just the ones we're associated with, the ones that you care about. And you can use these filings to figure out if you are happy with the way they're operating. That's what they're there for, really.
And I promise we won't talk about Form 990s next time.
That's true.
Or any IRS forms.
Yeah, it'll be a while. It'll
be a long time
before we ever talk about forms of IRS types anymore. So if you've gotten to the end of the show and you're like, oh my gosh, I just had to listen to a bunch of stuff about tax forms, you've made it through.
Thank you for sticking with us.
Go to the next episode if you're listening to these in order, or go to your next podcast knowing next time you hit a Software Freedom Law show, it won't be about tax forms.
See you then.
Software Freedom Law Show is produced by Dan Lynch of HalfBakedMedia.com. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. This show is released under the terms of the Creative Commons Attribution, No Derivative Works 3.0 United States license. The car alarm's been going for like 30 seconds. We can't even record.